This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences, and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks, and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat can't make it this week, but we are joined by very interesting guests all the way from Brazil. He is Pepe Escobar, journalist and author on various contemporary global political issues. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Great pleasure.
I feel very fortunate to have you in the studio this time because you have amazing international experience, because you've been on Press TV, you've been on Al Jazeera, you've also written for Asia Times, but you've also written books on Central Asia, Middle East, and you're from Brazil.
Yeah, I was born there by accident, actually.
Oh, okay.
I am a nomad that was born in South America.
So how did you develop this very global interest? Before we get into the topic more specifically, which is imperialism, I think you'd be a good resource to understand the current state of global imperialism. It'll be good for us to have a bit about your background.
Too. Sure.
So you were born in Brazil, and then what happened after that?
Yeah, I was born in Brazil from two European families, and I grew up basically with Hollywood, rock and roll, and classic European culture. Mm. That was my basic classic education, let's put it this way, with this extremely strong pop influence. So when you are a kid in the 60s and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones every week put out a record that, you know, brings the world upside down.
Right.
You know, that's it. You can never forget that for the rest of your life, right?
So that gave you the exposure to protests,
exactly,
to rebellion.
That gave me protest, counterculture in the 60s, flower power, a political protest, very important, from Berkeley to Paris in 1968, and then to Germany. And when I got to college, which was the early 70s, I was already commuting a lot with Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So I was
where in Europe?
Basically, Paris and London, which were the capitals of culture and political activity, especially. So this, in terms of forming your worldview in the years ahead, that was essential. As a kid in the 60s and as a teenager in the 70s and then in college, where extremely important stuff was happening. I'll give you just two examples. Richard Nixon, famous Nixon moment in China, which was something groundbreaking. And in South America, the famous coup against Allende in 1973 in Chile, which for my generation was our... We wanted to pick up Kalashnikov and go to Chile to defend the Chileans.
Wow.
With what? With records? Impossible, right? So crucial geopolitical moments and cultural moments at the same time. So after I finished college, I was wandering around Europe. And I had already decided that the only way to follow what was going on is to become a journalist.
Mm-hmm. Now, what inspired you intellectually to follow these movements? Because you can be, I imagine, in the 60s, just into the counterculture without being into the politics, right?
Absolutely.
Because the politics at that time demanded a more focused commitment.
Focused, a lot of reading, which sometimes was very hard if you were living in a country under a military dictatorship, because, you know, even if you wanted to read Marx or Lenin in a Spanish translation, that was forbidden.
Right. So what was your family background like? Was it petit bourgeois, or were they already committed radicals?
No, not at all. Very bourgeois. My father was a customs lawyer, for instance. My mom was a housewife. But they had a solid education behind it, which always helps. It starts at home, right? Like I started reading, listening to jazz and reading a theater and appreciating cinema and reading Stendhal or Voltaire at home. So that helps.
Right.
That helps a lot. And later on, because we were exposed to so much, there were two tribes in the 60s. This is very interesting, in the early 70s. The politicized and the flower power you know, let's hang out and just listen to records and smoke marijuana crowd. I was part of both. So I was already a freak at the time because I circulated in both crowds. And the fact that I had to listen to Pink Floyd for 5 hours in a row did not prevent me from reading books on anarchism, for instance, you know. So, and I was very attuned to what was going on in universities, in Berkeley, in California, Sorbonne in Paris, Free University in Berlin. And when I was in college myself, like, you know, the coup against Allende, we were having some of our teachers were some of the best teachers around talking about Frankfurt School, for instance, Adorno, Horkheimer, Marcuse, and all that. So it was a sort of, you could do a jelly of all those things or a mixed salad of all those things. And that would form your worldview. And this is what happened to me. And the cherry in the cake, as far as I'm concerned, is when much later on I made my decision to move and live in Asia. And that was much later.
Which parts of Asia?
I started in Southeast Asia. My first city in Asia was Singapore.
I see. So that was in the 70s? Or
no,
later?
No, that was much later when I was already a journalist. I was established and all that. And I was living in Europe, and I was already fed up with what was going on in the West. I had made a long trip across Asia from Bali all the way to Moscow and everything in between. And I went back to the West and I said, I cannot live here anymore. I have to understand Asia from the inside.
Fascinating.
As a Westerner, but you have to plunge into all those cultures. And especially with I had studied Buddhism, I had studied Hinduism as well. And I have to live there.
you know, that's the thing about growing up or just having your formative years in the 60s and 70s where militancy and alternatives were real options still.
Real options.
Because you could just join a group that's that's training in the jungle just 5-6 hours from where you live because people were mobilizing in a way that now I think for my generation we want the alternatives. It's, you know, we're still working in the liberal framework where everything's procedural, electorate and stuff like that, but for the most part, back then, this optimism was alive, right?
Absolutely, because that's the famous May 68 motto, believing the impossible. And my generation at the time actually believed in many intersecting impossibles, you know, like the Doors. We used to listen to the Doors as a call to action, in fact, like opening the doors of perception, which was the original idea, the music itself, and all those subliminal political messages in Doors music as well. So it was fascinating because it was opening up. And much later on, and I talked about this with a lot of young people, and many tell me absolutely the same thing. We have no way out anymore. And it doesn't feel good when you're young, full of hope, brimming with hope, starting your life, and you see that the roadblocks are everywhere. And at the time, it was exactly the opposite.
Right.
Jobs were available and we could actually change jobs at will. Or, you know, I'm going on a sabbatical for 6 months in Scandinavia. Why not? When you go back, you will find a job.
Yeah.
Try doing this nowadays, you know.
I don't want to sidetrack too much from the topic, but I do want to say one other thing that stands out about your generation is that culture would mirror this idealism because you had Bob Dylan, you had The Clash. They were idealistic. They wanted alternative world as well. And they were the soundtrack to your movements. You know?
It was exactly. We had the perfect soundtrack.
Yeah.
There's no question. Especially Dylan and then Bowie. And then after the punk movement, the Clash. Exactly. These are three seminal examples in three different parts of the 60s and 70s. Definitely. And they were capturing the zeitgeist. You know, the spirit of the times. All the time, in fact. And for all of us, it was a guideline. And what you said earlier about militancy is very complicated because many of us thought that, look, we if we join a militant group or if we do something like Bader-Meinhof, you know, those extreme left radical groups prone to violence.
Or the Jackal. Carlos the Jackal was another one.
Or Carlos the Jackal. We would reduce our, you know, margin of maneuver.
Correct.
So it was better In a sense, it was a very idealistic thing. Let's keep our options open. Let's try to find a way to interact with society, which would mean, in many cases, becoming a university teacher, mm-hmm. for instance. In some cases, becoming a journalist. Some other cases, becoming very good filmmakers mm-hmm. as well. Yeah. So you keep your options open, at least.
So I sense that you have very dynamic interests, from music to culture to intellectual history. But what made you eventually give your attention to the question of imperialism?
Well, because I grew up under the soft power of the U.S., mm-hmm. U.S. culture and pop culture especially. So you had the hedonistic element in rock and roll, and surfing culture, you know, blonde babes in bikinis, the California dream, mm-hmm. flower power, traveling around, going to Asia to learn about Buddhism, etc. And at the same time, you had the foreign policy right. element. What was the U.S. doing around the world in the 60s and 70s? So it starts with the Vietnam War. So I was part of the generation that grew up watching the Vietnam War on TV every night at 8. The leading story at the news at 8 was black and white images of the war in Vietnam. So mm-hmm. this was, I think, for the first time, a young generation was growing up with war on TV, mm-hmm. which was our case, right? So you start, okay, what were the motivations of the famous Kissinger domino theory in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And then what they were doing in South America, especially mm-hmm. during the 70s, this was terrible. In my case, when I was in college, there were military dictatorships all over the place mm-hmm. in South America. Brazil was not even the worst. The mm-hmm. worst was in Argentina and in Chile. Mm-hmm. And the Pinochet regime was something that, for the time, was the worst military dictatorship of the whole era, in fact.
Yeah, and I'm surprised too how the dirty wars, by and large, not overshadowed in left discourse, but I don't think it's discussed enough in Argentina, the dirty wars.
No, it was not, because the upper middle classes and the local bourgeoisie in all these countries, they supported these coups. In the case of Brazil, for instance, was in 1964, the military coup in Brazil, was supported by mainstream media, mm-hmm. was supported by the local bourgeoisie in Brazil that, basically was driving the industrial sort of a mini revolution in the country. Mm-hmm. And they didn't care about civil liberties, about censorship. And the fact, very funny, when Michel Foucault, for instance, the one of the greatest intellectuals of the 20th century, when he visited my university in São Paulo, he said, this is the first university that starts with a police force right at the entrance. Mm. It's the first thing he noticed. Is that, because he immediately noticed that it was a university under control and under surveillance.
Right.
So... That starts to form your cynicism towards power out of bounds. In Watergate, 73, mm-hmm. very important. But for many of us who enter into journalism, there was the click. Mm-hmm. For me, was I would say 90% for the click to get into journalism. Mm-hmm. I want to do something similar to what these guys
right.
did.
At that time too, right? You had the earliest beginnings of a global media consciousness.
Yes.
Yeah, that, like you said, watching Vietnam, and there was a sense too that empire could, was vulnerable, right? When you look at how the Viet Cong was fighting, and the idea that you could fight back, right?
Wow, but for young people, the way they admired the Viet Cong all over the world, yeah. Here in Asia and in the West, was exactly. They can do it, but it was discipline, a bit of luck mm-hmm. as well, because they were supported. We cannot forget that they were supported indirectly by Russia and China mm-hmm. as well. And obviously their skill and the vision of a mega leader, like mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. of course. So it was a very specific case, but it proved that empire was vulnerable.
Another thing I envy about your generation is that you could unite around a certain battleground in the way that I don't think the left could be in agreement about Iraq or Libya. In the way that the left globally could be in consensus about Vietnam, we have not seen that sort of overlapping solidarity, especially in recent battlegrounds against empire?
Definitely not, because it's too fragmented now. Mm-hmm. It's extremely fragmented, it's politicized, and the discourse on left and right is politicized, and it's like churches. If you are inside a leftist church or a rightist church, it's impossible to talk to the other churches. Mm-hmm. It's terrible.
Right. So
there's no debate anymore. And debate of ideas, which is something that we had in the 60s and 70s, when we still had the figure of the public intellectual that was respected by everybody. Foucault, for mm-hmm. instance, Sartre before him, Marcuse mm-hmm. in the US especially. And they would say something, they will give a speech in a university, and this would become an instant topic of discussion all over.
Yeah. It's like a concert, right, when they give a speech.
Like a concert. It's like the Rolling Stones playing live. No, it was Marcuse in Berkeley saying something about the U.S. in Vietnam. And that's exactly. Right. That was right. The topic. Nowadays, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. First of all, because you don't see the figure of a respected public intellectual anymore. When you look at the people who monopolize the intellectual discourse all over the world, which are basically think tank people, or people who have columns in newspapers like the New York Times or right. the Washington Post. And these people don't even know how to think.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're already blocked, and everything is ideologized, in fact, and they are not proposing a dialogue.
Yeah.
They're trying to impose their point of view. It's different.
And I would say the last remnant of that kind of autonomous, independent, outspoken left intellectual would be Noam Chomsky, although he's part of he's really,
exactly.
I mean, he's even earlier. He's from, I guess, from the first wave of, leftist discourse too. So, but let's take a break for now. I think in the first part of the show, I think you gave us a good sketch of the global landscape of empire then. And the second part of the show, let's address contemporary challenges in understanding
Perfect.
Empire, which I think you have a lot to offer as well. For now, let's take a break. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This week, we are joined by Pepe Escobar, journalist and author. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is Night School. We are joined this week by journalist and author Pepe Escobar, where we are discussing empire and its current manifestations. In the first part of the show, we situated your intellectual formation in a very exciting time politically in international relations. I do want to take our discussion back to when things started to change, right? There was a Sino-Soviet split that I think made the left anxious, right? Because at some point, you can say whatever you want about the regimes, at least there was a counterweight to US empire, right? And mm-hmm. there was not only just that, a very vibrant discourse. But when Sino-Soviet split happened, and eventually Cultural Revolution was defeated, and then you had China's invasion of Vietnam, things got a little bit confusing. I mean, where were you at that time, and what was going through your mind?
Well, I was starting my career as a journalist. That was the late 70s, early 80s. And I was very frustrated because I could not go straight into politics. Mm. When you start as a young journalist, and I would say this still applies today, you have to find your niche and then you expand. And you need a name recognition. Mm. So I thought, okay, I'm going to start with culture, especially music and cinema. And I have to wait. Mm-hmm. Politics, I have to wait. In the early 80s, for instance, I wanted to be in Afghanistan. For obvious reasons,
right,
because of the jihad. That
right.
was the thing happening at the time. Even before Reagan decided to turbocharge the jihad, that was the number one happening in foreign policy. Instead, I was writing about the clash, books,
yeah.
films, festivals, etc. Okay, but that's a start. But we could already see the primacy of neoliberalism, which was the great story of the 80s,
mm-hmm.
Reagan and Thatcher.
Mm-hmm.
But we still didn't know where it was leading.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it would take us many years later, for instance, via David Harvey,
mm-hmm.
when he wrote his fantastic brief history of neoliberalism, to mm-hmm. explain to us where this was leading, right? But I would say the key moment was really the fall of the Berlin Wall,
mm-hmm.
and of course the self-dissolving of the Soviet Union, and the beginning of the unipolar world for good. By then, I was in a very good position because I was already traveling around as a correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked in both in the US and in Europe, and I was flirting with the idea of moving to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when the Soviet Union fell for good, I was already traveling in Asia. I was between India, China, and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I arrived in Moscow only a few days after they pulled down the Dzerzhinsky statue mm-hmm. in front of the KGB. Mm-hmm. So I was extremely well located to, okay, my next step is going to cover, obviously, the unipolar world.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a glimpse already of what was happening. I had traveled in China before I took the Trans-Siberian to mm-hmm. Moscow. I was in Southeast Asia, then in India, then in China. I saw the beginning of the Chinese miracle in Shenzhen and Guangzhou, mm-hmm. and then in Shanghai, and then in Beijing. And then I arrived in Moscow. I said, okay, everything is changing.
Yep.
And I have to understand this. For it, of course, for everybody, nobody knew what would be the unipolar world
right.
at the time. If you know.
Do you still think it is the case now, unipolar world, given the rise of India, China, people are calling BRIC as a kind of counterweight? Would you still say that it is a unipolar world, that America is still the only player in town?
Like? Well, no, it's even more complicated. It still is, but you remember the Condoleezza Rice expression, the last throws. Now it's the last throws mm-hmm. of the unipolar world, and they are desperate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying this from any ideological point of view. The elites in the U.S. are absolutely terrified.
Can you give an example of what shows that?
Well, it's a concourse of circumstances in economic and political and geopolitical at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
While I have to try to be very concise here, otherwise we could go on hours, really.
Yeah.
While the U.S. was basically fighting this, I wouldn't even call them stupid, but in fact pathetic and senseless wars
mm-hmm.
from Afghanistan to Iraq, the Russians were reorganizing in their society, their economy, their politics, their military, and their geopolitical reach. It took them, under Putin and even with Medvedev, it took them 12 years more or less to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And China was growing all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
When the elites in the Beltway or in the nexus between Washington and Wall Street woke up to that, was already too late.
Mm-hmm.
Because now the gap was shrinking, including the military gap.
Mm-hmm.
So now you see, for instance, think tanks like the U.S. Navy Army College desperate to know what are we going to do against these subsonic Chinese submarines in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a geopolitician say, what are we going to do about the Russians now permanently based in the Middle East
mm-hmm.
With full reach in the Black Sea, with connections in Europe that sooner or later this stupid sanction story is going to collapse
right.
completely, because what the German industrialists want and what the Russian elite wants is business between Germany and Russia, which expansion for German business. They need the natural resources of Russia. So ties in with Putin proposed 6 years ago only to Germans in Germany. Let's do a huge emporium from Lisbon to Vladivostok.
Mm-hmm.
3 years later, what did the Chinese do, which was even more impressive? They picked up on this idea and they proposed the new Silk Roads,
mm-hmm.
One Belt, One Road, which is
right.
basically expand Putin's idea to the whole of Eurasia,
mm-hmm.
including China, but including Central Asia, Southeast Asia as
mm-hmm.
well, the Maritime Silk Road, the Indian Ocean,
right.
you name it. So this means total economic and trade integration of the whole continent of Eurasia. Nobody in the U.S., you know, in the think tanks, in the State Department, CIA, Pentagon, NSA, you name, they have no clue
yeah.
how far-reaching this is, because this is the big story of the 21st century. And was basically a Russian idea that became a Chinese idea, and now it's a Chinese project for, what, 60 or 70% of the world population for the rest of the century, in fact.
How do you read this as a progressive? Because you can frame this as just a story of the global expansion of the bourgeoisie, right? The,
yes.
the needs of the elites in Russia and the needs of the elites in China, finally finding the opportunity, given that America had overcommitted their military, right? Is there a redeeming aspect to this story, or is it just going to be the growth of two other problems that the world must face?
That's a very good question, because we still don't know. Mm. We still don't know. There are going to be so many technical and practical problems to implement the new Silk Roads mm-hmm. all over. Financial challenges, for instance. Can you imagine? They are planning to turn the Trans-Siberia into high-speed rail. This is going to cost, only this project is going to cost $250 billion, mm-hmm. which will have to be financed jointly by Chinese companies and Russian companies. Mm-hmm. The problem of the Americans are doing everything they can to cut off this nexus between Europe and Eurasia, mm-hmm. which means, why this whole story about Ukraine? To sever the New Silk Roads, right, for instance. Right. And just like Syria would be a very important Middle East node of the New Silk Road. Same thing. They mm-hmm. want to block the New Silk Roads right. almost everywhere. So there are many imponderables, and we still don't know. What we know is that this is a Chinese national security project, mm-hmm. which is a very, very serious thing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the Chinese and the Russians now have a strategic partnership, which they never had, in fact, mm-hmm. for the first time in over 50 correct. Years, yep. in fact. This is also very serious, because it's being decided at the highest level. And at the same time, the Europeans, I commute a lot between Europe and Asia, so I have to keep the pulse of what's going on in Brussels, mm-hmm. especially. And everybody's fed up with this sanction story, mm-hmm. because they want to do business. The only way for the EU, especially for Germany, to expand as a global trading power, which that's what they are, is to do more business with Eurasia, mm-hmm. especially Russia and China. And that's it. And they are prevented by the Americas at the moment. So we can expect in the long run, it's very complicated, because Europe right. is very fragmented. This is going to change. So the long-term picture is the U.S. being more and more isolated mm-hmm. and controlling a few pockets in the Middle East and now a few pockets in South America mm-hmm. after what happened in Brazil and Argentina. Especially.
Actually, I want to bring our discussion to that part of the world, because I think a lot of what Russia and China is doing is more evident in Central Asia and Middle East. But South America is a bit outside their reach. Maybe China is trying to reach it there too. But what's happening there? Especially after Chavez passed and now Rousseff's problems.
Well, it's the short caption would be the end of the pink tide in South America. It's much more complicated than that. It's the reaction of the local bourgeoisie and the local elites against many years of progressive and leftist governments mm-hmm. in place. In the case of Brazil, this was particularly drastic, in mm-hmm. fact, because they could not win. When I mean they, it's basically the social democrats that reconverted as hardcore neoliberals right. and the old rural aristocracy in Brazil. These are the people who are behind what, by any definition, was an institutional coup mm-hmm. that took place in Brazil against Dilma. So after, you know, two terms of Lula, one term Dilma, and half a Dilma term was too much. So they organized this institutional coup with help from the beginning, the NSA.
Of course, yeah.
Because the basic information about scandals in Petrobras and how Petrobras was doing doing corruption Brazilian style with everybody, they do it with everyone, with every political party. And the fact they even bugged Dilma's cell phone in Brasilia mm-hmm. was NSA. And all this information suddenly turns up to a very small-minded local prosecutor in a southern state in Brazil, not very important. Mm-hmm. And this guy becomes Elliot Ness. That was it was a right. fantastic story. And they sold this story very well. The Brazilian media sold this story very well. They supported the coup from the beginning. So where we stand now is the end of this mini progressive era in Brazil. And we're back to what we had before, which is the control basic of the Brazilian oligarchy. And in Argentina, it was slightly more, because they actually won an election. But Argentina is basically a very conservative country, much more mm-hmm. conservative than Brazil, in fact.
Interesting.
So for the Americans, this is great, because they recover the two top countries in South America now on the American side. It's not enough for them, because mm-hmm. In economic terms, the number one commercial partner for both is China, and growing and growing and growing. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese commercial trade offensive in Brazil and Argentina is going to continue. And they are buying companies in both. They are buying land in both. So, you know, their influence is going to be bigger, whatever the U.S. decides to do.
How about the rest of the continent? I mean, we haven't heard about Morales. Bolivia was for a while a focal point. Yes. Of course, I think Uruguay as well. And of course,
Uruguay
well.
Under Pepe Mujica, definitely. Yeah.
So the trend seems to, it's not dead or faded, but it seems to be really shaken.
Yes, it's not a trend anymore. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the smaller countries will continue to be ruled by progressives. Uruguay, Bolivia, Ecuador with Correa, same thing. Venezuela is a more complicated case because Venezuela, Maduro is not a statesman and he's extremely incompetent in economic terms. So he's not, and he's not Chavez. He's not charismatic. He's not a born leader. Or like Dilma compared to Lula. Lula and Chavez were out of this world, world leaders, in fact, and great politicians. With strategic thinking and great negotiators as well. If Lula was president, for instance, he would have controlled Congress with a few weeks of meetings. He was born to do that.
Right.
You know, and he was respected all over the world as even the Americans, when he was negotiator, they were negotiating with Lula, they were like, you know, he was. And Dilma, she didn't know how to do it. That was one of the key reasons for her impeachment, in fact.
Yeah. How does America's resumption of ties with Cuba factor into all this? Does it change
opportunistic
things?
No, very opportunistic. That's one thing about the State Department. When they see that they are cornered in a few parts of the world, they open up a hub somewhere. Okay, let's try to do something so we get some good PR. Which was the case with Cuba,
With Iran as well.
I was there at the negotiations. Wow. I covered the negotiations in Vienna. And it was great because we were a small group of independents and we had full access to the Iranian delegation. Mm-hmm. So we were getting the full story from the Iranian foreign ministry directly. They said, no, they're blocking everything at the last minute. Like Kerry is on the phone with the White House all the time. They don't want to concede anything, but they need to because they need a foreign policy victory, which was exactly what happened in the end. But they procrastinated for almost a month. Yep. Something that was already practically a done deal in writing when they got to Vienna, and then it unraveled completely. So that's the problem. There are too many. My Chinese friends tell me about silos of intelligence. A lot in China. In the U.S., in Washington, there are at least 20, 30 different silos. And they're all clashing for influence. And Obama was a very weak president. He didn't know much about foreign policy. So in terms of foreign policy, it was completely controlled by most of these freaks and some of them neocons. And neocons implanted in his administration. Very, very serious. And just a short addendum. If we have Hillary Clinton as president, it's going to be much worse because there is a neoliberal consensus. Right. And all the people she's going to pick are really, really
hawks.
American first, hawks, interventionists, humanitarian imperialists, and they are going to intervene all over the world, including in Asia. This is going to be very, very, very dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, after seeing what she did in Libya, right, you wonder what else is going to happen. Before we wrap up, some of your thoughts on what I see to be our version of the Spanish Civil War in a way, which is Syria, right? Because it's sort of galvanizing all these ideological forces.
Absolutely.
And a lot is read and projected on what might happen there because so much is going to change. What are your thoughts? Because some people say it's going to be the cycle of prolonged war, or do you see that both sides are exhausted and willing to rethink and renegotiate?
No, it could be as horrible as the Lebanese civil war that lasted almost 15 years. We are still the fourth year in this thing in Syria. If we get Hillary's presidency, something extremely nasty is going to happen next year because they already have a roadmap for that. I already wrote about this. In fact, they have one American think tank run by a neocon, by the way, and by the woman who might be the next Pentagon head, Michelle Flournoy. they wrote a report. Basically, it's the roadmap for foreign policy of Hillary administration, which is interventionist to the max, mm-hmm. and humanitarian imperialism. And they are proposing a no-fly zone in Syria, which breaking down means U.S. Air Force against Russian Air Force, mm-hmm. which is crazy.
Right, right.
This is not a proxy war anymore. We're going to next year. We're going to have a direct frontal confrontation between Russia and the U.S. We are approaching this stage. And this is absolutely horrifying, but it's not discussed in Western media at all.
Mm-hmm. How about Trump? Where do you rate him in the bigger picture of U.S. imperialism?
I've been writing about him because I happen to be in touch with some very powerful people in New York that support him discreetly. Mm-hmm. So they are feeding me information on what they would like Trump to do. Mm-hmm. They even fed me the program of the Trump administration, which is fascinating. Basically, three things. Contain immigration, so they can transfer these people they're going to expel as illegal immigrants, so they can provide jobs to unemployed America. Impossible to do it in 1, 2, 3 years, but this is what they would like to do. Number two, reinvest in the American military if that's what they needed. But in terms of streamlining it and stop importing electronic parts that are fabricated basically in China for weapons made in the U.S. Mm-hmm. This means delocalize American industry, which is something almost impossible as mm-hmm. well. And number three, prevent basically the European Central Bank, Europe, and the Chinese to do quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. That's it. Print money at mm-hmm. will. Only the American Treasury can right. print money as well. Basically, this is his program in a nutshell.
But how would you rate him in terms of international relations? Are you saying that in comparison, by aggregate, in terms of foreign policy,
yes.
he's less of a hawk than Hillary?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. First of all, because he doesn't know anything about foreign policy.
Right.
He doesn't know what Kazakhstan is, for right, instance. Right. Forget it. Even Malaysia, he will have a problem locating Malaysia on a map. Yeah. You know. So obviously, and what he said so far, and he means it, he wants a business relationship with both Russia and China, mm-hmm. which in geopolitical terms is a good thing, mm-hmm. whatever that means in a Trump sense, of course. And he will forget about Europe completely. He'll forget about South America. He will concentrate on make America great again, which is, okay, it's his way of putting it. We are going to become isolationists again.
You know, it's a very interesting time on one hand because you know that the empire is tired, exhausted. It's also isolated, like you said, because of overcommitting to these senseless wars. And you see these counterweights. Russia is doing significant balancing work in Syria, right? But at the same time, these are still very strong states. And gone are the days when we could see popular movements against imperialism. We still have to rely on the kind of necessary monster that is the state, you know, the neoliberal state. So basically what we have are clashes between different neoliberal visions.
It's exactly. So the nation state is not dead yet. Mm-hmm. As much as this rarefied class that is aiming for one world, mm-hmm. basically in terms of one neoliberal world, they're not going to achieve that because nation states still rule.
Right.
And the whole political system in the world, starting with the UN, they will have to, you know, smash the UN, start all over again to finish with the nation state concept, in fact. So the fact that progressives have to rely on Russia and China to do something progressive is awkward, mm-hmm. to say the least, isn't it?
Before we wrap up, too, there's also the question of dialectics, I guess, if we're going back to that old school outlook where this might be what it takes for humankind to pause and look at themselves again, like something bad, like World War One, right, where everything just broke out into catastrophe, and that's when they had to reconstruct themselves again, build new institutions, so on and so forth. And then World War II showed that that didn't work out. But sometimes the new questions that humanity must face can only be faced upon catastrophe and crisis. Unfortunately, that's what history shows.
That's what history, that's the historical record, no mm-hmm. question. Look, we had let's say an entree with the 2008 financial crisis, which is still the 2008 financial crisis, and it's going to get much worse. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. with Deutsche Bank, with the big American banks as well. So, and it was not a wake-up call because things continue to do the same thing. And in terms of the financial capitalism casino, it's even more concentrated than before. So if you don't dismantle this, you won't dismantle the system. For instance, there are four funds in the U.S. that control the 12 banks that are inside the Fed. The Fed is a private bank disguised as a public bank. And this is controlled by four private huge hedge funds like BlackRock, State Street, these people. If you don't interfere with the way they are controlling the casino, nothing's going to change. So whatever politicians say all over the world, nothing's going to change because these are the people who are running the... basically follow the money. You have to follow these four.
Oh, wow. Plenty of reasons to be cautious in looking forward.
At least.
So unfortunately, we have to cut the conversation here. But I do want to know if you have any recommendations for our listeners who do want to read up more on empire, on the state of global politics today. What books should they turn to? Well, you have your own books you've been publishing. So do you want to mention some of those that people can look up?
My books are... You know, the book that could be helpful to a lot of people is the one titled Empire of Chaos. It's a collection of columns that I wrote for Asia Times Online in Hong Kong covering the Obama administration from the beginning until until what, 2 years ago, roughly.
Wonderful. Okay, that's still contemporary.
So it has everything. Arab Spring, the war against Russia, the undeclared war against Russia, the rise of China, a lot on pipelines and Chinese economic expansion. This book could be helpful, in fact. It's a sort of, what happened in Libya when Hillary Clinton wanted to bring Gaddafi down? You find it.
I'm sure it's on Amazon.
Easy to find on Amazon.
Are you on Twitter?
No, I'm not. I'm on Facebook.
You're on Facebook. I guess people can look you up.
Very easy to find me on Facebook.
Yeah. Okay, wonderful. But thanks so much for spending time with us.
Immense pleasure to be in Malaysia. Thanks for you guys.
We hope you have a good stay here. And once again, you can email the show at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. That's BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space. Be sure to like that page if you haven't already. Once again, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and we were joined by journalist and author Pepe Escobar, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.